All right, we're in CSA world, which is, what is the CSA anyway?
What is the CSA?
Where are we and who are you guys?
We are in Red West over here at Microsoft. Uh-huh. We're part of, we're sort of part of two different teams. I'm actually part of the CSA concept development team, where the C, the S, and the A would be Chief Software Architect.
Okay.
So we're a group that works for Jack Ozzie, and we all report up to Ray. Mm-hmm. Who am I? I'm Stephen Lees, and I'm a program manager on the concept dev team. So one of the primary things that I own is FeetSync, and one of the reasons that we're here talking about it is to kind of just dig into how it works and how it works with Live Mesh. And speaking of which...
Excellent.
All right, I'm Steve Garrity, and I work on the other team that Stephen was talking about, which is the Live Mesh team, or the Windows Live Core team. Mm-hmm. And so I'm the PM for the storage service. So
excellent.
Basically, our usage of FeetSync comes out of, on the service side, comes out of the storage team, and on the client side, comes out of?
Comes out of me. I'm Akash Sagar. I'm a dev lead on the client team, and I work on Sync. It's primarily consuming the FeetSync feeds that come out of storage and publishing them back or sending them back to storage and getting doing sync in Live Mesh, especially that's file sync.
And what is nice to us, we actually accept the ones he publishes back.
Most of the times.
Sometimes we just reject them and for no reason.
Interesting.
We're working on that. That's bugged.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about just a quick... I don't want to dig too much into Live Mesh because we had a nice conversation with Avalad and other people that are on Channel 9 or going to be on Channel 9 soon. So let's talk a little bit about the complexities of sync. I mean, there certainly is a lot of syncing that goes on. I mean, Outlook syncs, this syncs, that syncs. Smart clients, one of the core features of a smart client is sync. So let's talk a little bit about what you guys have made specifically with this feed sync.
Okay. Well, you know, one of the interesting things to think about, sync is, I think you guys would have to agree, sync is not always a simple thing to do if you're actually trying to do it well and do it right. So there's sort of the question of, like, why are we doing this in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
And really, you know, it comes back to the software plus services thing that I'm sure lots of other people have talked about with you.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it boils down to the fact that we all have different kinds of devices, laptops, desktops, cloud services, maybe your phone or something. And so it's really cool if you can get access to your data on all those different devices. And, you know, if you take a picture on the phone, have it show up on your laptop, vice versa, you know, if you've got the pictures of the dog or something and, you know, you want to show them off to your friends or your grandparents, then, mm-hmm. you know, being able to do that just kind of on the fly on your device is really cool, too.
Absolutely.
And so we're trying to sort of tease out all those capabilities and make it happen in a really cool way.
Okay.
And so... You know, FeetSync started a couple of years ago because Ray was really trying to figure out how do we, you know, really build a platform, kind of this software plus services platform,
mm-hmm.
But also how do we do this so that we can kind of hopefully converge on, you know, a method for sync that works across, you know, a range of devices, platforms, technologies, everything. You know, there's a lot of interesting... A lot of times when I talk about this with people, I try to compare it, because a lot in the technology world, a lot of people have mail that works in the cloud on a, you know, laptop or a desktop and on their phone through some mechanism or other. You know, we all have it here through Exchange,
mm-hmm.
And Windows Mobile and that kind of stuff. And so I try to talk about, you know, having that capability, but now imagine as a developer, you can do that with your kind of data, right? It doesn't just have to be email.
Mm-hmm.
And also in a way that just is, you know, easily accessible to any other kind of application or platform. And so hence the feed part of FeedSync is we basically give you a way to sort of express your, you know, describe your data in terms of these feeds. And in fact, these guys can talk in great detail about how they're doing
good.
That.
We should do that today.
But, you know, you can describe your data in terms of feeds, and we add a little bit of extra sort of sync magic metadata to that.
Mm-hmm.
That allows you to synchronize it from endpoint to endpoint.
Excellent. So one of the things that happens in Live Mesh, coming back to the Live Mesh context, is it's not necessarily just all about data, right? Because you have to sync relationships. So I should be, and if my Live Mesh client is a mirror of the Live Mesh cloud or a subset, you know, sort of a fractal kind of representation, then I should be able to create new relationships offline
that will work when I get back online, and vice versa. Things can change in the cloud. Communication between relationship objects that then automatically get synced, right?
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So it's more than just syncing data, I guess is what I'm trying to spit out.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think there's an interesting difference between... you're highlighting, I think, one of the differences between the end-user experience that these guys provide, mm-hmm. which is really sweet, and it just kind of feels like it works like it should, you know, versus what actually flows kind of over the wire, under the covers to make that happen. And so I tend to be kind of that down-in-the-details kind of guy because, you know, Akash and I spend a lot of time talking about sync and just how it works and did we do the right thing with the spec in this way and that kind of stuff. And so we think of it as just like you're syncing this list of items. And these guys, actually, it might be really interesting if you guys sort of explained a little bit of the magic of how that translates into folders.
I think it's a great point. And the way we actually look at it, and Steve made a really good point, it's relationships are just data as well. Right, so we just look at it as from a feed sync level, we're syncing a bunch of data. Some of the data is actually your data, the customer's data in Live Mesh, and that's at this point that's, you know, files and folders. And some of that is then data about the, sort of how those relationships work and what's a subfolder and what file lives in which other folder. And that's actually been one of the really interesting challenges of using feed sync to implement Live Mesh is basically, like you said, feed sync is a sort of a flat list and it just thinks of things as feeds. Which is great from a sort of a compatibility and an existing concepts point of view. Web developers oftentimes already think in terms of feeds. Everybody's kind of used to them. But structured file systems aren't feeds. They're hierarchies or trees. And so actually representing a tree in a feed is, it's actually not a particularly hard problem in and of itself. It becomes very hard when you try to actually catch updates and keep the feed consistent at all times. And so Akash can probably tell you a whole lot of horror stories. About coming and finding sort of all the edge cases where you're moving things around. But the simplest way, I guess, just kind of give you an overview of how we look at this. We basically divide up the data into sort of metadata and actual basically what amounts to user data or binary data and closures. And so we look at metadata as basically all things that describe a file. And that's kind of what we end up attaching the feed sync stuff to. And so this is like the file names there and the size and things like that. Kind of the metadata you think about a file normally, read-only, whatever. But the actual sort of merging stuff is, oh, we attach a GUID to it so we can actually uniquely identify it. And then we point it off to an enclosure. And so there's basically, anytime you have a file, we'll actually store that separately and just point to it using the sort of this atom entry that we use to call it data entry. And so the data entry then can also have a parent ID, which is how we actually just start to represent the relationships we're talking about. So where does this file live? Oh, it lives, you know, at the root. So it's got a parent ID of zero or something. Oh, it actually lives in this other subfolder? Well, the parent ID can point to a different data entry. And so we kind of separate the two out, and then we can actually sync enclosures differently from metadata.
Interesting.
I don't know if you want to add to that, or if you want to talk about some of the edge cases, or if you have other questions.
Yeah, on the client, we once we pull down these feed sync feeds, we also have to update the file system. So we go through another step that that Ray calls realization, which is kind of taking all the enclosures, pulling them down, and updating the file system so that it's as consistent as possible with the feed. And that's really tricky because you don't have you can't have transactions that span the file system and our database. And so you always have the case where you know you're trying to do something, but the user goes and makes an edit, or the user deletes a folder, and you have to kind of keep up with it and try to catch all the corner cases. And that's really what makes it a hard problem.
Excellent.
But I'd like to say one more thing about our usage of feed sync, especially. As you pointed out earlier, there are many hard problems in sync. I mean, auth is a hard problem. Kind of multi-master is inherently a hard problem. Synchronization protocol is a hard problem. When it came to feed sync, if I remember correctly, it was about 3 or 4 months ago when I implemented the protocol, and it was kind of over a weekend or something. And we kind of said, okay, synchronization protocol, hard problem number one, done over the weekend. Now let's worry about the other ones that we have. And that was really cool. That was amazing.
But let's talk about that. There's a reason why you can say that, because not all protocols could be written in a weekend.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about what the protocol is, how it works.
So FeedSync describes a set of metadata if you want to exchange pieces of information. And a logic for how to perform merges in case that there are edits that are made on different endpoints, and it is that logic that I think The entire team on the CSA side has done a very good job of trying to keep it as simple as possible and not trying to overcomplicate it with super rich data structures or you know, dealing with all edge cases in kind of very specific terms. They try to keep it as simple as possible. And so you can write the implementation in C#. You can very easily write the implementation in JavaScript and have it run inside a browser, which is also very cool. And so in our case, it just ended up being a very small piece of code that you know, we don't spend much time on maintenance later on.
Excellent. So I think one of the things that was cool that we've done before that I remember when I was learning about how NT, what happens on Windows, this was back a ways, when you double-click on a file. And so we started in the shell,
yep.
And we went all the way down in the kernel to the I.O. manager.
Okay.
And it was really kind of an interesting way to jump down the rabbit hole. So let's talk about, let's create a folder. What happens, right? I mean, why not map out on the board like all that really happens when someone goes new folder and you know, see what happens. I mean, I think that's a good example. It's sort of an operating system.
More or less.
So we have a component called the file system watcher that's kind of sitting on top of your file system in TFS or FAT32. And it's looking for changes as and when users do things on the file system. And so in case you add a new folder, the watcher detects that there's a new folder that was created over here. And the watcher kind of goes to our local store, which is a database written on top of SQL CE.
Mm-hmm.
And inside this database is your FeedSync feed. So the watcher in this case would add a new entry to your FeedSync feed, and that entry would describe the folder. So let's say this is new folder. And it would add the FeedSync metadata, which is inside VSX sync element. Now we have another piece up here that's called the synchronization engine. The synchronization engine is the one that takes the feed from the database and kind of hands it off to the storage service sitting in the cloud. Now, the storage service is responsible for taking this local feed and merging it with the master copy that it has over there, and firing notifications to other devices saying that the feed has changed. Let's say this is device one.
And the storage service lives in our data center, right?
Yes, the storage service resides in our data center. And Steven can probably give you more details over there.
Yeah, whatever you want.
So when the second device, when the synchronization engine on the other device receives a notification, it goes and pulls down the incremental changes.
As a feed, right?
Yes, it pulls down the incremental change as a complete feed from the storage service, and then it kind of updates the local store, so the corresponding feed in the local store. And the file system gets updated after this via the realizer. So this would create a new folder on disk.
It's pretty simple, right?
Well, it's just a cool name. So the cool thing about the realizer is that that sort of gives you an abstraction layer to the underlying operating system.
Yes.
That your client happens to be running.
Yes. So the realizer is also responsible. Now, if you look at these two devices, I mean, one might be running Windows, the other might be running Mac, the third might be running something else. Mm-hmm. So the realizer is kind of responsible for taking the canonical feed representation and doing the appropriate update on the file system.
Absolutely.
So on the Mac, for example, you know, file names are case sensitive, mm-hmm. and so you can have two folders, one with capital F, one with small f.
Mm-hmm.
On Windows, you can't. Mm-hmm. So the realizer would know, would be smart about it, and kind of appropriately do the writing on the file system, move the other folder, rename the other folder, squirrel it away somewhere else, and inform the user that there was a problem.
Excellent.
Yeah, so it might be interesting to actually walk through kind of a little bit of how that works, with because that's kind of the details of FeedSync that are so brilliant, right?
Yeah.
And so the way you can think about this is, once this has all happened, let's say you've kind of created a new folder, and we created a folder that's called, you know, Akash is really cool. Mm-hmm. And then it syncs down to my device over here, and I said, oh, actually, I really want that to be called Steve is really cool. and then actually it synced to Steven's device over here, and kind of using the same process in D3, and he thinks the same thing. He's like, nah, but I'm Steven, and Steven is really cool, and so we're going to rename the folder at the same time. And so what ends up basically happening is each of the individual clients will have its local database that Akash was talking about, and it will each basically say, oh, okay, I've detected a change in the watcher, the file or this folder got renamed, and it'll change the data. So we'll go from new folder to, you know, whatever we're going to call it, foo. And then over here we might have one that looks, I'm going to draw D3 over here real quick, and I'll replicate all of it, but we have an entry, and this one might be bar, and we have SX sync, and these are the entry, and a lot of extra data. And the first thing that happens is when this data gets updated, we update the version number. And so at this point, this one is both, I always forget, is it version?
Or
is there, I think it's updates, right?
Yep.
I always think it's version, I know it's not actually called version.
That's kind of what it is, though.
So right. It's effectively version number, though.
Yep.
So updates equals, start off with 1, this is actually when it's new folder. The first thing that happens is it'll go to updates equals 2. And over here, we're going to have the same thing, and it was 1, and it goes to 2, and I'm not going to rewrite it all.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're actually going to store in the SX sync element, among other things, the history. And so I'll actually basically know who's had previous copies of this. When they both get fired up to the cloud, so what will happen basically is one gets sent up to the cloud first.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of other housekeeping things here I'm going to skip until I need them later. One gets fired up to the cloud says, oh, this I've detected a rename. That's great. And so the folder is now called foo because the foo change won. And it got there first. So the folder, the change is now foo. No problem. It sends up a bunch of notifications. At the same time, D3 is saying, oh, I detected a change too. And so it's going to send up this notification to the cloud and say, hey, I want to rename this thing to bar.
Mm-hmm.
The cloud is going to look at it and do a merge, or the client, depending on kind of who's seen this first, and say, oh, wait, I have two changes with the same update number, but they're from different authors. And so one of the things that we talk about in here is what the endpoint was that authored the device is a by field. And so that's based on a per device. In this case, you could use it. Any implementation of FeedSync could have its own endpoint sort of naming system. We in Live Mesh use devices, because that's kind of what ends up actually authoring a change. It's on a device. It's not a user, because as a user, I have 4 or 5 Live Mesh devices right now.
Sure.
So if I author changes, don't know why I want to do this, but if I wanted to set up 2 PCs side by side and rename things, I shouldn't lose data because of that. So we use devices to sort of uniquely identify who's doing updating.
Okay. And that would be like just the machine ID.
Exactly. It's basically sort of an ID for the machine in the mesh.
Sure.
And so as the merge algorithm is running, we're saying, hey, we have these two feeds and we're trying to stick them together. We'll detect that, or FeedSync will really detect, that there are two updates with the same version number, but with different author fields. Mm-hmm. And basically say, hey, I have a conflict. And so what will end up happening, and this is sort of one of my favorite parts of the protocol, there's a very simple deterministic way to resolve, quote-unquote, resolve conflicts. Mm-hmm. And it's important here to distinguish between resolving conflicts in the protocol sense and resolving conflicts in the user sense, which is what we end up doing is saying, okay, we're going to pick a winner. And the winner is going to be, start off with it's the highest version number, then is it the most recent change? Or is it the by element next? I think these two backwards.
No, that's
so memorize it.
First you check the updates.
Yep.
If the whoever's got the greater updates, right. Then after that, I think it's just the when.
It's the when.
It's the when, and then if the when's the same, it's the by. Okay, so it is when and by.
Cool.
So whichever was the most recent change wins, and if they're both at the same time, it's sort of whoever's first in the by list. Mm-hmm. That's not actually necessarily the way that the user wants the conflicts resolved. So the cool part is what happens is we actually keep the conflicting entry around and say, hey, there's kind of this entry, which is the quote-unquote winner of the contest, and then there'll be another one stuck in saying, hey, here's a conflicting element. You might need to inform the user of this.
Okay.
And so the cool part is, because this is a deterministic algorithm, all of the endpoints are going to resolve it the same way. So all of the users are going to kind of see, and this system converges.
Hmm.
You're no longer in a state where it's conflicting with itself. It's not a consistent state.
And that was a pretty important aspect of the algorithm, is because you could have all this state flowing, because FeedSync is a multi-master, you know, at least it can be a multi-master algorithm, you know, and all this data is flowing around from different endpoints. We wanted to make sure that every endpoint would, you know, when presented with the same data, would sort of merge to the same state.
Mm.
So
that's interesting. So it's not, it's you can't really call it atomic in a transactional sense, but it is sort of a way
it's
that
totally
you're...
It's totally async, that's right.
Yeah.
But it's predictable, that's the important thing.
Excellent.
But as Steve was saying, I mean, that's kind of where it starts, is at least, like, from the system point of view, now we have a consistent state, and then you can kind of figure out, okay, what do we do with that?
Right. I think the best description I've heard of the conflict resolution protocol was deterministic but arbitrary, which is to say that the user might not actually agree with the way that you resolve this, right? You might not want the latest change to win in all cases. Maybe, you know, one of us updated it with old data, and then one of us had new data but updated it previously. We just hadn't talked out of band, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Or I just didn't like the conscious change.
Exactly. Or I just didn't like the change, and the conscious still wants to go back and resolve his to win.
Darn.
Then it's just a matter of who has, you know, latest access to the database. But it basically resolves it in this deterministic way, so the system still converges. Mm-hmm. And then we still end up telling the user, and this is getting back into, the live mesh implementation of it,
mm-hmm.
we tell the user, hey, there's a conflict. Which one do you actually want to choose?
Mm-hmm.
But the nice part is the system already thinks there's a winner and a loser or a list of losers.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay because now the system's in a consistent state.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't actually tell the user, hey, this is the one that won. We say, hey, there's a list of conflicts. Which one do you want to choose?
Okay.
And that makes it sort of, that means the user can actually resolve them in sort of the correct way for the user. But you can imagine each application resolves these differently, right? You could actually imagine a system using FeedSync, which was different, which at the application level always resolved conflicts to, you know, have Steven win. Because Steven implemented the system, and he always wants to override conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing it does is check the author. In fact, I have I always wonder when I share folders with you if it always resolves that way. Akasha, the client, so maybe it works that way.
But I think
but you could always have automatic resolution if you wanted to, right?
That's a really good point. Is one of the cool flexible things about FeedSync is that we try to sort of be, you know, provide the application with the right abstraction and the right model. And so there's definitely times when, you know, you're just complicating the user's life by actually trying to shove this decision in their face, and sometimes
mm-hmm.
you can actually just say, nope, you don't need to think about this one, I got it covered.
Mm-hmm.
Other times, you know, it's actually better for the user to choose, because hopefully, and this is what, you know, you guys have been working on, is like you present them with interesting information that helps them make a smart decision. So
right.
It's actually, I think that's one of the most fundamental things both about sort of a FeedSync ecosystem and about Live Mesh in particular, is just this, it's a very human notion. You know, if we're all working on a document or something, it's totally natural. It flies around an email. You know, Akash sends me a version of the FeedSync spec, and
mm-hmm.
Steve sends me some other comments, and, you know, and I've been working on my own version. And so, you know, it's just totally expected, you know, in the human sense that there's these three different versions floating out there. And I'm actually going to, you know, try to use the tools at my disposal to figure out how do I resolve that into one thing.
Mm.
And so FeedSync kind of presents that as a core, you know, piece of the system.
Interesting.
And it's very different from something like SharePoint, where, you know, only one person kind of checks out a file for write, and then no one else can write to it. Over here, you're free to edit the file, and FeedSync will detect conflicts and preserve them so you don't lose data.
So let me ask you this question, though. This is probably a client-side question, but... very often, when you're transmitting data from a client to wherever it happens to be going, the network can go out from under you.
Yes.
And so when you're dealing in a transactional context, that's really not the end of the world, because there'll be no commit.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about what you do.
Let's
look at that case. Like, so I say, you know, I create a new folder called C9 videos, and I did this today.
Yes.
And of course, that folder has about, you know, 120 gigabytes of data in it, so we're obviously not going to sync the whole thing up.
Yes.
Probably wasn't a good
experiment. We didn't give you that big of a quota yet.
No, not yet. Not even for me? Not even for Channel 9?
Not yet. Let us
know. Okay, cool. So let's talk about, like, what happens when a sync fails due to conditions that, of course, you have no idea.
Yes. So the part number one is we cannot have transactions that spam our clients on the cloud, otherwise the system's never going to work. So we don't even try doing that. Point number two, which is kind of important, is that FeedSync merge algorithm is idempotent. So you can take the same set of data and kind of apply the merge logic over and over again, and you know, you'll get the same result at the end of it. So what we do on the client is we keep a list of entries that we haven't sent to the cloud, but the watcher detected as being changed locally. Mm. And then we batch up changes and try to send them up to the cloud. Mm. And if you know, it's certainly likely that we send a batch up to the storage service. It gets mm-hmm. committed over there, but before the ACK comes back to us, we lose connection or we go offline. So what will happen in that case is the next time you come online, we'll send the same batch over. It will get committed again, which will be a no-op in the storage service, and we'll get an ACK back. And when we get an ACK back, we mark it in our database as being, as you know, having committed in the cloud, and then we move on to the next batch.
Excellent. And the really cool part of that, and the point that Akash made that it's idempotent, is the FeedSync protocol being so simple just sort of greatly simplifies our lives, and it just makes building a correct system so much easier. Mm-hmm. Storage service doesn't have to worry about, did the client get the ACK? Oh, is this, am I going to get the same feeds again? We actually just literally, they post the client posts a new feed to us, or what they think is new. We just run the merge and commit it and don't care. It's not like we have to track, oh, you know, they're sending the same feed again, we shouldn't do this, oh, did they send half a feed or anything? Whatever we get from them, assuming, you know, you can basically think of each individual item merge as atomic, mm-hmm. which is say, like, if you only get half of the XML for an item, you're obviously going to throw it away. But if you get literally, if you get the XML for an item or for an entry, you can run that merge as many times as you want, and it's always going to work. Mm-hmm. And so it makes our lives much simpler, not having to track what does the client have, what have they told us, what have we already processed, what did we fail on. As long as we just run it and continue running it, the system will eventually converge mm-hmm. On the right sort of end result. Now, obviously, we do a bunch of tricks to try to do that as little as possible because it's expensive. You're doing a lot of IOPS, mm-hmm. Grabbing stuff from the database and merging things. But we don't have, none of those have to work mm-hmm. for the system to function correctly.
That's a really cool aspect of the sort of the layer architecture that Akash was drawing on the board. It's just, you know, the fact that these pieces are all separate. So you've got, you know, the watcher that's kind of figuring stuff out and pushing it into the local database as a feed, and then you just kind of queue it all up. It's very, you know, internet-y.
Exactly.
It's very webby.
But of course, I guess the question that has to be asked is the one of scalability, right? I mean, as this becomes the de facto way that Windows Live happens, or, you know, let's mesh, and we have millions and millions of people on board, how does this scale?
Wait, it was supposed to scale?
Damn.
New requirement.
Yeah, new requirement.
That's, so that's actually a very good question, and we have thought about it occasionally.
Of course.
That's a really good question. The nice part about it, scaling is actually a little bit orthogonal to the sync protocol in a way, which is basically you can partition things on the back end or shard them and basically kind of run all of this separately. Mm. And so assuming that I have the data objects we talk about, and I don't know if you heard about this in some of the discussions you had in the past with core objects in the mesh or live folders, we basically end up sort of being able to partition all of our back end amongst, you know, different core objects. And so you can pretty easily run these operations, and the operations aren't particularly expensive to do, like a merge of a feed. And I don't remember our performance numbers off the top of my head, but they're totally reasonable to merge feeds. This is a pretty simple algorithm. I'm sure it wasn't simple to develop, but it's simple to run.
Yeah.
And let a single front end handle a fair amount of load. And as long as that front end can be easily partitioned, thus far we haven't seen issues with the scale of the architecture.
Sure. So, and of course, the scaling you were talking to was in the cloud as far as the server infrastructure.
Yep.
But there's also the notion of scaling of how big can a mesh be, right? I might have a gigantic mesh.
True.
With an enormous amount of core objects and relationships. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just curious.
Sure.
Sometimes, you know, we use in the live mesh sense, we're talking about devices, right?
Right.
I get all my data, Windows, anytime, you know, Windows everywhere on any device, right?
Right.
Sort of. Windows in the sky. So I was just thinking in terms of the way that you can scale the mesh.
Sure.
Right?
Well, so again, there's a limit to sort of client resources. So you can think about what's expensive on your client. You only have a certain amount of disk,
sure.
Obviously. And so hopefully our database never gets really that big because it's just metadata. But we talked a little bit earlier about how we separate sort of what we call enclosures from metadata. Mm. And so there's an interesting concept where you can basically have a bunch of metadata for for items, and not necessarily bring down all of the files. So actually what might happen with your Channel 9 folder mm-hmm. is you might want to share that with me, or I might want you to share it with me, mm-hmm. so I can have all these Channel 9 folders, and I want to watch some videos on the plane. Mm-hmm. But I really don't want 120 gigs of Channel 9 videos on my laptop, because mm-hmm. I'm really coveting one of those new solid-state drives, and they're not 120 gigs yet.
Sure.
In some cases. And so I kind of only want to pick the top 10 videos that I want to watch, because it's only an hour, you know, 2 hour plane flight. Mm-hmm. And so I can actually pull down, I have the ability of sort of the architecture to only pull down certain set of files.
Excellent.
And so this is something we're sort of talking about, and it's not in the product, but the FeedSync mm-hmm. protocol gives us the ability to do stuff like this
nice.
And separate out sort of the actual data, which is the sort of space consumption mm-hmm. from the metadata of the object. And I could even have sort of essentially a library available to me on my device of what's available in the mesh mm-hmm. and not necessarily have to have all of the data locally, which would take up the space. Mm-hmm. There's other constraints on the client around, you know, obviously, processor usage or whatever. Mm-hmm. But again, we're talking about, you know, relatively simple algorithms to run.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we can handle relatively large feeds without having to worry about just doing some processing.
So now this is a little bit outside the context of this technical conversation, but I was just thinking as you were speaking, I could see some, you know, devilishly clever kind of person syncing their Windows folder and all of the related binaries that are needed to just have Windows run somewhere.
Right.
And then I could put that up in the cloud and share it with my friends.
Yep.
Anyway, I mean, that probably won't happen. But it would be interesting to see how we could lock down. I don't know what I'm asking, but that's an interesting scenario that I'm not sure people have thought about, but there must be some kind of restriction as to what I can share in the sky. How would you do that?
Well, no, I just, like, I mean, you could copy, I mean, you could put your Windows directory, you know, you could copy it all on a USB key or a USB drive today.
Or burn this DVD, give it to my friend.
But there you go. I mean, we're not doing anything fundamentally different.
So it's a fair question.
I was just going to say, I think, you know, there's... I think the system was designed more around, you know, the user data kind of scenario, mm-hmm. and things start to get tricky, I'd imagine. I don't know if you guys have run into this, but, you know, when you try to sync system-y stuff.
Yeah, syncing your page file is a really good idea. Fantastic.
It never hurts anything.
System gets into
non-stop
really,
sync.
Really fun states.
Yeah. Yes, I think someone actually tried syncing the log files that we were dumping out and was wondering why the system was just running forever because as we were syncing, we were just writing the log files and we were syncing them again. It was a perpetual motion machine.
Perpetual sync, exactly.
Yes.
So we've been in a perpetual motion as we've got along. It was
interesting.
One more thing we do actually on that note is that we have a notion of roles associated with members in a core object. So different people have access to modify data, and different people might have access only access to data. Mm-hmm. So you try to protect your data a little bit, and also on the client side, we try to if there's an accidental delete, we mm-hmm. always try to make sure that your file ends up in the recycled bin. We never hard delete it. Mm-hmm. So you should not get into a situation where you have complete data loss across the mesh.
Interesting.
It's one of my key nightmare scenarios, actually.
Yeah. Let me ask you this real quickly, because I was playing around with this. What's the relationship between live mesh client and UAC? Why does UAC need to be enabled?
That was a breaking change that happened in Vista. Mm. And the COM rules, I don't remember all the rules at the top of my head right now, but the COM rules for accessing the registry changed depending on whether UAC was enabled or disabled.
Okay.
And the only way we could get the client working reliably with the shell extension that we have was to have UAC enabled. And that was more of a Vista change than...
Sure.
The client uses per-user COM. So the client's explicitly designed, for a number of reasons, to be a per-user system, mm-hmm. in the sense that if there are multiple people using a PC, they should be able to have their own live meshes and not be basically dependent on a single install, on a single set of data, on a single number of things. And so it's designed explicitly for that scenario.
Which is
helpful if you...
calling out, because it is super cool that, you know, a lot of apps require admin install, or they're once per machine, and they're really kind of... pervasive in that sense.
Right.
So I think it's really sweet what you guys have done with the
and exactly. It's all credit to the client guys for any sort of family PC at home.
Yeah.
It's sort of a great help for that scenario. And so like Akash said, there was a breaking change in Vista. I believe there's a fix.
I believe they've reverted it in SPV.
Yeah, so
they're working on whatever delta needs to be done.
Yeah, but it's certainly not something that we're, you know, planning. Like, it wasn't planned that we don't support machines with UAC off. we're working on that with the appropriate people.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is kind of a side effect of this cool scenario, which is basically supporting multi-user installs is super helpful for a lot of situations.
Excellent. Very cool. So someone else has walked in here.
I wonder who it could be.
That's my boss.
Who on earth is this?
Sort of.
How are you doing?
Good.
Who are you?
I'm Vladimir Fedorov.
Join us.
I'm a lead for storage services, and Steve is my PM.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Akasha owns the client piece that talks to the storage services. So I work with those two guys.
Excellent.
Do you recognize this diagram?
I would probably subdivide the storage service into more boxes.
Let's do that.
You can tell it was drawn by a client.
Let's please do that.
Giant block.
I was just waiting for him to say no.
Yeah. Interesting. So we have just been talking about what happens when you create a new folder and set it to sync. And so it's this really nice conversation. You know, the storage service is simply just a cloud in this picture. We can talk a little bit more about it if you'd like. I mean, probably should.
Yeah, I can give a little more detail. In reality, the storage service stores two types of data.
Mm-hmm.
Blob data, which is just binary enclosures, which correspond to file content. And metadata, which corresponds to description of the content, such as the name of the file, the length, who it was created by, and so on. And those two types of data are stored in different backend stores. One is stored in a system which is a SQL-like for the metadata, and the other system is oriented more towards storing large binary blobs. When you just create a folder or a file, the first thing that goes up to the cloud is the metadata, and then at a later point, as in this diagram, does show or does not show? I'm not sure.
This one was just a folder creation, so we haven't gotten to...
You haven't gotten to the binary.
I talked about the enclosures a little bit. It might be interesting to talk about like the ERF and stuff, like the retrieval feed and how we handle publishing. And we haven't talked about peer-to-peer sync at all either.
All right.
Which would be interesting to cover.
So the metadata arrives first to the storage service. At that point, we make judgments about the quota, and we reserve some space for the file once it actually arrives. And then the file is sent by the client at a later date. Once it arrives, it's stored in the blob store, and there is a link from the metadata, which is later discoverable through LivePC or through the client. And that link is stored in the metadata, which points at the binary blob. Clients themselves can share binary blobs. They use the metadata to figure out which blob they're talking about. So when one client requests a blob from another file, they exchange metadata and they say, I want this particular blob. Or they can request them from the cloud. When the cloud needs some blobs for which metadata has been uploaded, but the blobs themselves have not yet arrived, it publishes a feed in which it describes which blobs should be uploaded to the client but have not been uploaded yet.
Cool. So can we just dig in quickly into the binary blob in the sense that what if just a slight change happens? First of all, the binary blob is a representation of something, a cool object
music,
or whatever. You got it.
Video.
So it could be a video. Let's say it's a Channel 9 video covering Live Mesh, and I have to edit something out, which they hopefully, most likely, is not going to have to happen. But
it's
so,
probably
oh, wait, you're going to edit out that other comment I made?
Absolutely not. So my question is, if I just wanted to slice out a little segment of the video, I guess here's what I'm really asking. With the binary blobs in databases, typically when you make changes to any of the properties, let's say it's an object that has properties and you make a change on a property, you have to get the whole blob down, hydrate it, make your change, and then dehydrate it again in the database, right? You can't like write a script that says, update this field to this binary blob. At least you can't do it in a SQL-like context.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that work?
So the way it works, in our system right now, there's a feature which we really wanted to get in the initial release, but we didn't, which is called remote differential compression.
Nice.
Which helps this scenario, but it's not yet in the system. So the way it works right now is the client notices that the binary blob has changed. It recalculates the hash for the blob. And then this hash is used to identify the blob throughout the system. It then updates the metadata to indicate that the hash of the blob has changed. So the metadata in the cloud now points to a new hash. And then the client uploads the video, the updated video, to the binary storage. And other clients and the website client can get it from there once it's been uploaded.
Cool. So in today's system, we really don't differentiate between a really, what you'd consider a small change, or sort of a very drastic change. So you can imagine basically changing the metadata on your video actually literally only changes probably 10 or 20 or 100 bytes in the file, which might be a gig. Mm. If you go through and do some sort of, I don't know much about video editing, but I don't know, figure red eye reduction in a video or something, that's a problem. But some sort of operation is actually changing most of the keyframes or most of the frames in the video, and it's going to change a big part of the file. Mm-hmm. We don't actually distinguish between that today.
Sure.
The feature that Bud's talking about, RDC, would basically give us that ability. And it's sort of, the system's based on enclosures are, we call them blobs. There's really large chunks of data, but they're subdivided into blocks. And basically that lets us kind of already have a lot of the plumbing in place here for if you only change one block, we can actually deal with that. Now, we aren't yet sort of smart about how we choose blocks and how we actually allocate things and compress them so that we can actually do this really cool, hey, you only change 100 bytes, we only have to send, you know, 100 bytes over the wire. But we have a lot of the framework in place to do that, so hopefully one of these days, Vlad will stop making videos and actually write some code. Yeah. And
so it's essentially a file system.
It doesn't have the file system semantics. It's more of a flat store of blobs scoped by a security group.
Okay.
So the scope is who can access the particular blobs. But it doesn't have any hierarchy, nor the blobs themselves have any type. They're identified purely by the hash. So your video and your photo look exactly the same. They may only differ by length.
Interesting.
There's also some really cool properties for us, because we don't care what they are necessarily. It could all be encrypted, and it wouldn't. The system kind of just continues to work, right? It's just it's a stream. It could be a file we don't understand. It all just kind of works. At least it's supposed to.
Yeah.
With the system, sort of, it's binary. We don't actually care. You can stick whatever you want in there.
Yeah, actually, that's a really interesting point because we've been talking about files mostly because obviously that's, you know, we've got this sort of initial version of Live Mesh, and that's one of the big features. That there's other stuff, other cool stuff too that we could talk about, but you know, in general, like the mesh is really a platform, and you know, just as with FeedSync, you can put, like, we don't actually care. We sync stuff. You know, we don't really care what you put in there, and so it might be interesting to talk a little bit about, you know, obviously we can't talk in too much detail, but you know, like the storage service in general holds whatever you want of stuff in there, and so down the road, I think we'll have more interesting examples of.
And that's an interesting design decision, right?
It's
an important design decision.
The system is meant to be highly generic, and also because of privacy concerns, we don't actually want to know what's in the data. So the system is also built in such a way that we don't know, and your data, we don't need to know in order to provide the functionality that you need in the system. So it's hashed data. We know the hash, we know the length, but we don't know anything else. And the remote differential compression allows us to break it down into smaller chunks, which we may exchange simply parts of the data, like just the tag of your picture when it's changed into the whole picture, still without knowing what the data actually represents. It's just a sequence of bytes that have some values, but we don't actually know what it is, and we don't need to know.
So anything that really fits that model of kind of metadata plus blob, basically, you know.
Right. Which it turns out is a really common developer paradigm, right? One, everything fits into those two buckets.
Yeah.
But also, you tend to see this a lot, right, where this is kind of how file systems already do things in a way. You can actually think of, if you like go back to, like, you know, like old FAT or FAT32 systems, they describe things this way.
Yeah.
There's probably a bunch of other things. For email, you could actually argue is sort of, right, structured structured data, which is the text, and then you have a bunch of attachments that are binary attachments. There's probably a bunch of other things you can come up with here. Photos are obvious in terms of tags and the actual image stream.
And it's a super common feed thing, obviously.
Exactly, and obviously feeds work that way.
Kind of anything you stuff in feeds today, like blogs,
is either structured
photo
or
descriptions, whatever. Yeah, you've got a hunk of structured data and a hunk of unstructured data.
Absolutely.
So
the other advantage of having these blobs kind of separate from the feed is that you can have a different protocol for downloading the blobs. And what we do today is we do support clients talking P2P to each other and pulling these blobs down, so they don't necessarily have to hit our storage service all the time. That kind of makes it a little bit more efficient.
Interesting.
You can certainly think of cases where you have two machines on the same subnet, and those cases could be optimized because it's a very high bandwidth P2P connection that is possible for those two devices.
So is this ad hoc peer-to-peer network construction, composition? Let's talk a little bit about that. How does that work?
Our P2P connections are brokered through the cloud. So we kind of have to rendezvous in the cloud to take...
Like Messenger, right?
Yeah, so kind of like Messenger, yes.
Actually, we use some of the Messenger technologies.
Yes.
Okay.
One of the cool things about that, too, that I think I've seen you guys answer some questions about, so if Charles has his, 120 gigs of Channel 9 videos, hypothetically, so you're saying that he can sync those really quickly between, two peers on his gigabit Ethernet or something. But then I had the impression from a question I saw that the cloud will do interesting stuff, assuming you guys up his quota, if he's really nice to you. Mm-hmm. Then the cloud does cool stuff about pulling that data from the clients too, right?
We don't nearly do as much cool stuff as we can do. It's an initial release. But since the only piece of data that has to propagate to the cloud before this exchange can begin is the metadata. As soon as the metadata is in the cloud, it's then sent to all of the clients. What we do is when the feed changes in the cloud, all of the clients receive a notification, and then they pull down the incremental change to the feed, which would, for example, be the metadata described in Charles's video. And from that point on, they can set up a P2P connection, like Akash said, and actually exchange the data. When you go and you browse the data, for example, through the web client, it's smart in such a way as to indicate to you that the actual video is not yet available in the cloud. It's only the information about what it would be. And then either of those clients or both of those clients that now exchange the video can upload it to the cloud. And once it fully arrives, the metadata changes to indicate that the video is now available in the cloud, and you can pull it down through a web client.
This is pretty slick.
The cool things we were planning to do in the future version was to interleave uploads from multiple clients for data which is available, so that we can schedule, client A will upload the first 10 blocks of the data count, client B will upload blocks 11 through 20, and client C will upload 21 through 30, which we don't do yet in the initial release.
But you got to save something for V2, right?
Exactly, yeah. Job security is important, yes.
Oh, it is. You got plenty of it. This is really interesting stuff.
But you can also imagine a bunch of the peer-to-peer stuff like Akash was talking about. You don't even need to have your data in the cloud, which is one of the other cool things. And again, sort of partially implemented right now, but the system supports it. Even if we don't have enough quota for you in the cloud for your 100, let's say your 220 gigs of Channel 9 video become 120 terabytes of Channel 9 video because you're making a lot of videos.
Almost happening.
And I totally believe it. And you're getting a really high res, camera and all kinds of cool stuff. All of a sudden, we actually really don't have 120 terabytes of disk to give you today. But you can actually just take all this stuff peer to peer, and basically, it never actually has to make it up to the cloud. Either if you don't want it to, or if we just don't have space for it in your quota, then you can actually basically single stuff peer-to-peer and just use it to synchronize the metadata. And there might be stuff that you actually want to do that with. There might be stuff you don't want in our cloud. I don't know why.
True.
Great people.
Taxes.
Taxes.
The cool thing that the storage service does is that quota determination happens when we upload the metadata, and quota is reserved at that point. So we don't get into a state where we're trying to upload the 120 terabytes, and then we upload 1 gig, and we say, oh, sorry, no more space. Just uploaded. I just wasted bandwidth for 1 gig. So if we upload metadata, we know at that point which files can make it up, and space is reserved, so we know that these files, we will be able to successfully upload them without any problem.
So now, one of the things that came to mind when you were talking about limitations and the need or not requiring people to use the cloud to store is, what if I had a 120 terabyte hard disk? That could be a device in my mesh.
Yeah, and you'd be attached to a PC. We don't have, you know.
Well, yeah, it has to have an operating system. Well, you guys are going to figure that out. Yeah. Operating systems are so 70s, man.
Oh, yeah.
Come on. But,
can it run JavaScript?
Why not?
I can run JavaScript, you're all set.
But I'm saying that could be interesting to have sort of in other words, my own storage service is what I'm talking about. I'll take care of it and take Microsoft out of the equation of posting my data, which is not a big deal. Are uptight.
In fact, we've designed it so that the only piece that really needs to be not federated, which is what you're describing as kind of federation of storage services. The only piece that's not federated is the piece that determines your identity, which is the account service. Once your identity is determined, your actual metadata can be stored by many storage services, and it should be transparent to you and other clients which particular storage service are you getting your metadata from. Right now, the only one we implement is our own, but the system is built to federate, so it could be enterprise storage services or private storage service boxes, just like an appliance in which your data is stored. As long as we can make identity decisions and authorization decisions, thank you, Steve, we'll be okay.
Cool.
That's a kind of a cool point about the sort of the open, that we've been talking about a lot of the open standards and that we've been sort of focused on in the webby design of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Is basically everything is actually essentially linked, I mean, literally using hyperlinks and hrefs. So the data structures are all basically self-describing and sort of traversable. And so you can kind of point things at effectively whatever you want. And so each one of these things, like, for example, the entry will have these things. We're talking about enclosures, and so I don't want to go too far into the weeds here. But you can imagine one of the other things in here is an enclosure descriptor. It's actually a series of enclosure descriptors. It'll have a link in it, which points to where you get the file. Right? And this is kind of very much back to what Stephen was talking about with sort of just the way that the web and feeds normally work, mm-hmm. right? It's all sort of describing, and you can make that point to whatever you want. If you really wanted to host it on your web server instead of the storage service, I mean, the system, you know, the Live Mesh UI isn't built around that right now,
mm-hmm.
but the system actually kind of just handles it, and FeedSync works that way. So it's all self-describing. So if you want to have multiple storage services, you just start kind of changing some base URIs, mm-hmm. and you're off and running now. There's a bunch of code to write on our side, but I don't want to make it sound too simple. Because, like Vlad said, we need some job security, but otherwise, the system's really pretty in that system, and a lot of credit to CSA guys for a system that's sort of very self-describing and makes a lot of sense in terms of being able to, like you said, it's very 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 internet-y.
Yeah,
what was your description of webby exactly?
Yeah. Well, I think that, and it sort of comes back to the way that you guys have, modular is a great word, because it comes back to the way that you guys have layered the architecture. So, you know, obviously this is a very, very, you know, mesh is a super sophisticated example of, you know, somebody implementing FeedSync to create this kind of mesh data experience. But the cool thing is that, you know, at the bottom of the stack, I can reach in and just kind of open the FeedSync door, you know, onto the storage service. And maybe I don't have quite a sophisticated implementation, but I can actually still go, like, sync the folder to my own, you know, space and do interesting stuff to it and update it, and I can, you know, get my own local feed and actually, like you said, kind of follow the links and browse around. And if I wanted to create, I don't know, you know, the interface from Jurassic Park with little girl on her Unix system, you know, I can take the feed and do my own rendering of what the folders look like and still make changes and come back and give them back to you at the end of the day. So
can I have that when you build it? Because that would be really fun.
Vista Gadget, man.
Sweet.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So just not on 64-bit, huh?
Oh, of course.
So this is interesting because the thing that strikes me about all of this now that I've had a few conversations with your team is it's a pretty simple core architecture, like the notion of feed sinks and the way. So rather than over-engineering, this could easily have been over-engineered, but instead you took a simpler route, which is pretty elegant. I guess elegant is probably a better word than simple, but it's just human understandable. And I think that's really interesting that you guys went down that path for the feed sync technology in it. As far as the brain surgery you had to do to get it to work in live mesh, that's different. It's a mesh of complexity.
Yes, and as a platform, we did not want to box ourselves down to saying, you know, we can only do files and folders. We wanted to have the extensibility. We wanted to have kind of the federation have different storage services in the back end. We want to have different kinds of clients, not just Windows clients on the front end. We want to have the ability to sync data with applications that are mesh aware, but that are not Microsoft applications. So you can take data from the mesh or pull data from external sources and introduce it into the mesh. And FeedSync kind of allows us to do that because it's a bidirectional sync protocol.
Interesting. And that's important in this, the age of interoperability.
Yes.
Very cool. So what, you know, we've covered a fair amount. We haven't dived into the watcher, but everyone knows what a file system watcher does. Realizer, very interesting. Sort of a operating system abstraction layer. And storage service with what we can talk about right now. This seems to be somewhat clear, the generic model. It's very interesting. So unless you have something else you want to dig into, I mean, Channel 9, these are democratic conversations. I'm not leading anything. So this is very cool. This is really helpful. And
cool.
Great job, you guys.
Is this going to be a question?
Thanks.
No, I think that covers it.
Cool.
Cool.
We'll be back.
Oh, yes. Nice to meet you all.
Me too. Thanks.
Cool.